Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJM Framingham.
Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Friday, December 5th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by Pam and Pamela. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Pam.
And this is Pamela.
Military leaders show video of boat. Top military officers on Thursday showed senior members of Congress a video of a September 2nd attack on a boat suspected of carrying drugs, including a follow-up strike that had been at the center of a growing debate over the Trump administration's lethal mission. General Dan Kane, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Admiral Frank M. Bradley, a top special operations commander who oversaw the attack, met with members of Congress to discuss the operation and defend the decision to launch a second strike that killed survivors of the first missile. The military officers briefed the Republican chairs and senior Democrats on the House and Senate Armed Service and Intelligence Committees, as well as defense appropriators, all behind closed doors. Lawmakers briefed by Bradley said that the admiral denied that he was given any order, written or oral, to kill them all, or to grant no quarter, rejecting public reports that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had directly ordered the follow-up strike to kill the survivors. But Republicans and Democrats left the closed-door meeting drawing starkly different conclusions after watching the unedited video of the initial strike on the boat and the follow-up that killed the survivors and sank the boat. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas and chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, called the attack righteous and highly lawful and lethal. He said that the video showed two survivors trying to flip a boat loaded with drugs bound for the United States. The follow-up missiles were exactly what we expect our military commanders to do, Cotton added. Representative Rick Crawford, Republican of Arkansas and chair of the House Intelligence Committee, said that there was no doubt in his mind that the Defense Department was carrying out the strikes in a highly professional manner. But Democrats exited the briefings even more concerned about the campaign against drug smugglers that to date has included strikes on 21 vessels in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean that have killed 83 people. Several Democrats characterized the unedited video of the September 2nd attack as disturbing and called for its public release. They said that the footage only prompted more questions that the Trump administration needed to answer. Representative Jim Himes, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, who for years has been read in on sensitive counterterrorism and covert operations, told reporters that the attack video was one of the most troubling things I've seen in my time in public service. You have two individuals in clear distress without any means of locomotion with a destroyed vessel who were then killed by the United States, he said. Senator Patty Murray of Washington, the top Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, said after viewing the footage that more accountability was needed, and she called for Hegseth to be fired. It could not be more obvious that Secretary Hegseth is unfit for the role, and it is past the time for him to go, she said in a statement. This briefing confirmed my worst fears about the nature of the Trump administration's military activities, said Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, in a statement. The classified meeting demonstrated exactly why the Senate Armed Services Committee has repeatedly requested and been denied fundamental information, documents, and facts about this operation, he added. Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi and the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has raised questions about the decision to attack the survivors. He did not respond to questions, exiting the briefing on Thursday. Democrats have been highly skeptical of the campaign, arguing that all of the boat attacks amount to extrajudicial killing or even murder. Several said after the briefings Thursday that they still want to see Hegseth testify about the administration's policy of carrying out lethal military attacks on boats it says are carrying drugs, rather than allowing the Coast Guard to intercept the alleged traffickers. If President Trump can pardon a convicted narco-terrorist trafficker, how does this campaign where we are targeting and killing folks on the open ocean to prevent their trafficking of drugs anywhere, how is that even legitimate, said Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, after exiting a briefing, referring to Trump's decision to pardon Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras. Lawmakers were expected to press Kane and Bradley on a range of questions about their mission, including about the original order from Hegseth that called for the boats to be sunk, the drugs to be destroyed, and the people on the boats to be killed. The lawmakers were also expected to drill down on the military's planning for what to do with survivors, the approval of those plans, and the reasons Bradley thought that a follow-up strike was justified. Military officials have said that the survivors were a legitimate target. Legal experts have questioned that. While top Republicans on Thursday rejected the idea that the follow-up strike constituted a war crime, their Democratic counterparts declined to weigh in, saying that they wanted more information from the Trump administration. I can't think of a more serious accusation that could be made, said Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. I'm not going to make a judgment on that until I have all the information. The questions surrounding the September 2nd strike have heightened scrutiny of Hegseth and Bradley. Current and former military officers have rallied to the admiral's defense, worried that he might be held singularly responsible for killing the survivors. William McRaven, the retired admiral who oversaw the operation that killed Osama bin Laden, said Thursday that while he did not know the details of the strike, he had deep trust in Bradley, who said he was one of the finest officers I've ever served with. In the 30 years that I have known Mitch, he has always displayed a strong moral compass, impeccable character, and someone I trusted to do the right thing under even the most difficult of circumstances, McRaven said.
Don't be fooled by cold days in New England, region with the fastest warming in the world. Remember winters of saving newly shoveled parking spaces with beach chairs? Or layering up to play pond hockey in the bitter cold? Well, despite this week's burst of frigid weather in New England, those days are becoming increasingly rare, according to a new study. New England is among the fastest warming regions in the entire world, not just in the United States, having experienced more than 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.5 degrees Celsius, warming between 1900 and 2024. Nowhere is that warming showing up more than during New England winters, when temperatures are rising twice as fast as in other seasons, bringing significant losses in snow cover, according to the study published Thursday in the journal Climate. We are in this transition from a stable climate to an unstable climate, and we really need to prepare for it, said lead author Stephen Young, a professor of environmental sustainability at Salem State University. The new study adds recent data to a trend Young has been documenting for years. With its proximity to the Arctic and its relationship with the Atlantic Ocean currents, New England is experiencing above-average warming. And what's particularly notable, the study points out, is that recent data shows those trends are accelerating. Over the last 5 years, temperatures in New England have risen faster than in any other five-year period since 1900, according to the study. During that same time, New England lost more days with snow on the ground than in any five-year period since 2000, when a satellite that tracks snow cover was launched into space. Historically, winter temperatures in New England have averaged around the freezing point, said Jennifer Francis, senior scientist at Woodwell Climate Research Center, who is not part of the study. As a result, she said, it takes only a little warming to melt fallen snow or to change a snowstorm to a rainstorm, or to turn a white Christmas into a soggy one. And while New England is warming faster than much of the rest of the world, within the region, Massachusetts is warming the fastest. Between 1900 and 2025, average annual temperatures in Massachusetts rose 5 degrees, and average winter temperatures increased 7.7 degrees. And the last 5 years, the state had 31 fewer days with snow on the ground, with decreases especially high in the spring and fall, the study found. Elsewhere in southern New England, Connecticut has had the largest increase in winter warming, with average winter temperatures up 8 degrees. Both the Connecticut and Rhode Island have seen more than one-third of their days with snow cover disappear since 2000. At the root of all this warming is the increase in greenhouse gas emissions caused by the burning of fossil fuels. In 2023, three major greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, which comes mostly from agricultural production, reach record observed cumulative highs. But why is New England warming faster than the other regions? It has to do with geography, according to the study. In the waters off the coast of New England, three related changes are happening. The Labrador Current, which brings cold water from the Arctic, is weakening. So is another ocean system, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, a global conveyor belt of currents that bring warm water north and cold water south. And the Gulf Stream, which carries warm Caribbean water up the east coast of the United States, is warming at a faster rate than the oceans around it, and is also moving closer to land. This warm water is now on the coast of New England, said Young, and has the result of heating up the entire region. This warming is showing up in all sorts of way, said Maury Pelto, a professor of environmental science at Nicholls College in Dudley and director of the North Cascades Glacier Climate Project. Snowmobilers, skiers, ice fishermen, snowshoers, for that group of people, their industries are impacted, said Pelto, who is not involved in the study. Lakes that are freezing later and for less time are also more prone to growing algae in the spring and summer, which is bad for water quality and year-round fishing, he said. Then there's the maple syrup industry. They rely on a long, cool period of dormancy in their trees, he said. If you don't get that dormancy, you're not going to produce the same syrup. Those kinds of changes are easy to see, and they make climate change more readily understandable in New England than it might be in some other places that are not so far affected. But it's also true humans have short memories and busy lives, Young said, and it can be easy to experience cool weather like this fall and feel the urgency around climate change drop off. We humans have a problem of confusing weather with climates, he said. Weather is incredibly variable, and climate averages out all those variabilities and gives a signal. And the climate signal is that it is warming and snow cover is decreasing. Pam?
A diploma and something more. By requiring real-life skills, some schools may offer a model to replace MCAS. In Jean LaBelle Pierce's senior project class at Maynard High School on a recent day, one student was researching the UN's response to war crimes in Syria, another, the ethics of breeding animals, a third, pediatric patient recovery. A day before, local community members in a variety of careers held mock job interviews for students. A day later, LaBelle Pierce taught the students about saving for retirement. I'm learning more than I thought I would, said Rowan Casanas, a student in LaBelle Pierce's class working on a research paper about safety and stress on college campuses. In Maynard, this daily class has been a graduation requirement for the past few years. As Massachusetts scrambles to craft new statewide graduation standards to replace the MCAS, programs like Maynard's will almost certainly be a core component, inspired by a national movement in education towards requiring real-world skills. Advocates argue that projects give students the opportunity to work creatively, practice communication, and solve concrete problems. But experimentation in some districts and other states suggests creating a consistent standard for student work across communities, which will take substantial effort. On Monday, Governor Maura Healey released a broad outline for new graduation requirements, including both locally graded projects and mandatory state-graded tests. Business leaders and some educators applauded the approach, arguing that testing would ensure all students meet uniformly high standards. The Massachusetts Teacher Association, which led the charge to abolish the MCAS requirement, said Healey's proposed test poisons a once-in-a-generation opportunity to reduce standardized testing, which it argues turns teaching into narrow test preparation. The governor's seven-part framework, which also included a requirement for financial literacy, emerged from an advisory council Healey created in January, led by the State Secretary of Education and the Commissioner for Elementary and Secondary Education. The council aims to complete more detailed recommendations by June, which would then need approval from the State Board of Education and possibly the legislature. Whichever way the testing debate plays out, something like Maynard's senior project is on the horizon. This would add Massachusetts to the short list of states that require projects or portfolios, or include them as an option alongside test. LaBelle Pierce's class, with its instruction on financial literacy and the workplace, also fulfills multiple other aspects of Healy's framework. Maynard belongs to a consortium of districts that have project-based programs, known as performance assessments, that could be adopted as graduation requirements. The small-scale efforts show that such programs can engage students and stir them to produce impressive work, educators said. But there could be a gap between what works in a small school with a devoted teacher and a statewide system where children in every community must meet the same requirements. Some other Massachusetts districts, including several regional vocational schools, also require a final project or portfolio from seniors. Colorado has offered senior projects as a graduation option for a decade. Rhode Island created new graduation requirements in 2022 that include a performance-based diploma assessment, such as project-based learning. Teachers and districts participating in the Massachusetts Consortium said ensuring the same quality of work was required in all districts that remains a challenge. And other questions remain, including which projects should require cumulative capstone projects featuring research, writing, and a presentation, and whether to use cross-subject approaches like Maynard's, how to adapt projects for students with disabilities, and in which grades to assess students. In Maynard, each of the school's roughly 80 seniors completes a research paper, an internship, and a project. In the spring, they present their projects to small panels, including local community members, and show off their work to hundreds of students and community members at a science fair-like showcase. In prior years, Maynard students have educated residents about the town's history, written a musical, and built a model rocket, and so on. Gavin Bartlett, a 2022 graduate of Maynard High, did his research paper on the state's housing crisis, and has remained engaged on the topic in college. Bartlett is a senior at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, studying political science, and is looking for work in public policy or the law. It makes the high school diploma mean something, Bartlett said of the class. You've got to have something to show when you graduate. I think test scores may not be the best way to do that. The Massachusetts Teachers Association Union and the Massachusetts Association of School Committees recently published a report with their own graduation recommendations. Authored by Harry Fetter of nonprofit education advocacy group Fair Test, the report called for performance-based assessments such as capstone projects or portfolios of student work, but not statewide tests. Pamela?
Bipartisan House group proposes health care plan. With support of 15 Republicans, it is a long shot. A group of 35 House Republicans and Democrats on Thursday released a plan to scale back and extend for 2 years the Affordable Care Act subsidies set to expire at the end of the year, a long-shot effort to address soaring health care premiums. The plan has the backing of roughly 15 Republicans, far short of the majority of the majority standard needed to compel House leadership to allow a bill to reach the floor. Almost all the Republicans who endorse the measure represent swing districts and expect to face tough re-election races next year, underscoring how potent the issue of rising costs has become. With enhanced health insurance tax credits set to expire at the end of the month, Democrats have been intensifying pressure on Republicans to join them in backing an extension, their chief demand in the government shutdown fight that ended without any action to address the issue. The new House proposal, led by Representatives Josh Gottheimer, a New Jersey Democrat, and Jen Kiggins, a Virginia Republican, would extend and reduce the tax credits in a two-step process requiring two separate votes by Congress. The first vote would extend the tax credits for a year with some modifications, including the addition of a new income limit. The second would implement what the group described as more significant reforms, including potentially eliminating $0 premiums, with exceptions for need-based support. We're calling for a vote by December 18th in both chambers of Congress to get something done before premiums rise in January, Gottheimer said at a news conference at the Capitol on Thursday. As part of our plan, we'll also work together on a menu of longer-term reforms to help families continue to save on their premiums. Kagan said she had 40,000 people in my district who rely on this health care. Doing nothing to prevent a spike in their premiums is wrong, she said. Whether her party might act remains to be seen. There is little appetite among most House Republicans to extend a provision of the Affordable Care Act, a law most of them revile. President Trump has not weighed in on the issue publicly, although last month he was reportedly considering backing an extension of the insurance subsidies. That came amid warnings from his pollsters that voters could punish Republicans at the ballot box in November if the subsidies were not extended and Americans saw spiking premium costs. In the Senate, Democrats plan to force a vote next week on a three-year extension of the tax credits that would leave them at their current levels with no income limits or other reductions. It is expected to fail for lack of GOP support, but party leaders are eager to use the vote to prosecute their case in the midterms against Republicans. It's going to be one of the most important votes we take, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic leader, said on Thursday, because it's showing who is on the side of the American people and lowering their health care costs, and who is on the side of the big special interests and is going to raise health care costs. Pam?
CDC panel may drop support of hepatitis B vaccine, but recommendation will stand in Massachusetts. Since Donald Trump's election, Massachusetts Public Health Director Dr. Robbie Goldstein has been preparing for a situation that once seemed unimaginable. A presidential administration limiting access to life-saving vaccines for millions of Americans. The scenario is now a possibility. On Friday, an influential vaccine advisory panel could end a 34-year national consensus on the importance of vaccinating newborns against the liver infection, hepatitis B. If the panel, which advises the Centers for Disease Control, reverses the long-standing recommendation that all infants be immunized at birth, it would be the most significant policy change yet under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., undoing an inoculation strategy credited with virtually eliminating the illness among infants. And that may be only the first step. The panel is also expected to reconsider the entire vaccine schedule for children, according to the latest agenda for Friday's meeting. The panel was considering multiple options for changing the administration of hepatitis B shots on Thursday, but delayed a vote to Friday after some members voiced confusion about the language of the recommendation, with some even expressing concern about taking such a step altogether. "We don't even have a slide explicitly describing what questions we're supposed to answer," said committee member Dr. Joseph Hibble during the panel's meeting on Thursday. He noted the wording in the resolution has changed three times in 72 hours. Many leading figures in America, in American medicine, say that there is no scientific basis for Kennedy and his appointees to question the efficacy and safety of tested vaccines. One of them told the committee that directly on Thursday, Dr. Jason Goldman, president of the American College of Physicians and a liaison to the committee, castigated them for cherry-picking studies, lacking transparency, and failing to grasp the importance of the decisions that they were making. "You are wasting taxpayer dollars by not having scientific, rigorous discussion on issues that truly matter," he said. "You're basing this whole presentation on the concerns of individuals who want to refuse the vaccine." But however ACIP panelists vote, the decision will virtually be irrelevant in Massachusetts and six other Northeast states, including Maine, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. These states, members of the newly formed Northeast Public Health Collaborative, issued their own recommendations for hepatitis B last week in a proactive move that Goldstein described as pre-bunking. Those states reaffirmed the long-standing practice that every child should receive the vaccination within 24 hours of birth, and within 12 hours for those whose mothers test positive for the virus. "Rather than let them go out on Thursday and Friday and say that we know what they're going to say, which we know is false," Goldstein said, "we would go out strongly and backed by science and state what we know to be true." Health officials have said that withdrawing the universal recommendations for newborns would create significant barriers to access, since insurers and pharmacists in many states rely on ACIP to determine what vaccines they make available to customers and when. Also, not all mothers have access to Hep B screening, so cases would slip through. Before the U.S. implemented universal newborn vaccination, thousands of children each year contracted the virus, and many from their contact with their mother's blood during labor. Even delaying things by a couple of weeks hypothetically increases your risk across the board, said Dr. Charles Hannum, a Tufts Medical Center pediatrician. The current newborn vaccination guidelines are not mandates, and parents can opt to delay the dose. Nearly 80% of American infants receive their first Hep B vaccine within 3 days of birth. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends children get their first dose of the Hep B vaccine at birth, a second when they are between 1 and 2 months old, and a third between the ages of 6 and 18 months. The virus can lead to liver disease, liver cancer, cirrhosis, and liver failure. About 90% of infants infected in their first year will develop chronic hepatitis B. The Northeast Collaborative's proactive messaging is a confidence boost to doctors and public health officials in the region and is critical to shoring up confidence in vaccination, said Carlene Pavlos, executive director of the Massachusetts Public Health Alliance. Waiting to issue guidance after ACIP's decision, she added, would allow misinformation and confusion to percolate. It preempts chaos. Fewer kids are getting immunized in Massachusetts, and recent Boston Globe Suffolk University poll found that about 16% of respondents either disagreed or were uncertain whether the benefits of vaccines outweighed the risks, an unusually high number, given that Massachusetts traditionally is among the most vaccinated states in the country. Local physicians said patients have been noticeably more wary about the Hep B vaccines. In the last 6 months, I've seen an increased skepticism for Hep B. The Trump administration says any decision will be based on science. ACIP will review the evidence at its meeting this week and issue recommendations based on gold standard, evidence-based science, and common sense, said Emily Hilliard, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which houses the CDC. The ACIP panel has become a flashpoint in a national debate over vaccination policy. But at its core, it represents a tug of war between science and ideology, said Goldstein. Based on everything we've seen and we've heard so far from Secretary Kennedy over the last 9 months, we have real concerns and very little confidence that they will put out will be sound or based in science, said Governor Maura Healey in a news conference on Wednesday.
A heist of escargot rocks French Village. Nearly all of critical holiday supplies stolen. It was not quite the Louvre heist, but for a village in northeastern France, the recent theft of more than $100,000 worth of escargot from a local farm, just as prime holiday snail eating season begins, was pretty close. The family that owns the business believes that the target, and especially the timing, suggests that whoever did it had insider knowledge of the esoteric escargot industry. The French eat about 37 million pounds of snails every year, according to the National Heliculture Federation of France, which represents snail farmers. Much of this consumption happens around Christmas and the New Year, as evidenced by the inevitable annual appearance of holiday escargot recipes in French magazines. The heist appears to have been timed to coincide with this period of exceptional demand. Escargot is quite a rare dish. It's pricey, and usually serve for Christmas or big events, said Inès d'Auvergne, 20, who works in her family's snail enterprise and whose father, Jean-Mathieu, discovered last week that they have been robbed of almost their entire holiday stock. We think there are people who know, a connoisseur or a professional, to be able to steal 1 year's worth of stock at just this time, she said. On November 24th, she said, her father went to work as usual at l'Escargot de Grand Cru, the business his parents started in 1999. It now consists of a snail farm, shop, labs, and kitchens, and that morning it was obvious as soon as he arrived that something was amiss. The door of the shop was open. The doors to the kitchens and the labs, where cooking and cultivation experimentation happened, were also open, and drawers in the office were emptied of petty cash. Most alarming, nearly all the escargot, 990 pounds of fresh and frozen snails, were gone. That stock was meant to get them to the high demand of the holiday season. Just before Christmas, we find ourselves without much, Inez d'Auvergne said. The police have no suspects yet, she said, and the family is scrambling to contend with the loss. The d'Auvergnes are among the only several hundred snail-farming families in France, where the supply of the mollusks in the wild has been depleted. Regulations limit gathering them, and cultivation does not meet demand. People have been eating snails for at least 170,000 years, and snails have been a snack in the Mediterranean for about 30,000 years. They are relished in Italy, Spain, North Africa, parts of Asia, and the Caribbean. Much of the growth in the global snail market, valued at about $700 million annually by some estimates, is driven by demand for the mollusks in skin care. Snail mucin is hot in Korean beauty products, a booming international business, as well as in pharmaceuticals and in food. In France, local growers account for only 5% of the market, according to the National Snail Farming Federation. Small French snail producers say they struggle against bigger producers abroad and face tricky conditions. During COVID-19 lockdowns, for example, critical holiday sales plummeted. The d'Auvergnes produce about 350,000 snails annually, selling them online, in markets, and to high-end climates such as Le Parc, a restaurant with two Michelin stars in nearby Reims. They are part of a network of cultivators serving the regional businesses that cater to the many wine tourists passing through. Their snail farm is itself a tourist attraction, promising an escargot tasting and a presentation on cultivating moss. Because it takes about a year for snails to reach maturity, there is no way to make up for the losses from the theft in time for the Christmas rush, d'Auvergne said. Fellow snail raisers have shown solidarity, she said, offering supplies to help the family. The family learned of the world's interest in their plight after customers told them of news reports from across France, Europe, and Asia. d'Auvergne said she hoped the people hearing her family's story would support other small businesses.
Minneapolis Somalis targeted since Trump rant report an uptick in ICE activity in neighborhoods. The usually bustling Carmel Mall, a hub for the city's Somali residents, is quiet. Signs on the mall doors declare, "No ICE enter without court order." Nearby, a Mexican bakery and a neighboring taqueria are closed. Immigration activists and lawyers say Somali residents have been pulled over, asked for their passports, and detained by masked immigration and customs enforcement agents this week after President Trump called the state's Somali immigrants garbage that should go back to Somalia. "I have been getting calls all day and night from people who should not be at risk," said Carmen Gebnick, a Minneapolis immigration attorney who has described talking to naturalized citizens or permanent residents scared of being detained. Trump's rant against Minneapolis, which has the United States' largest population of people of Somali descent, about 80,000 residents, have put this community in an unusual position. Most Somali immigrants came to the country decades ago and have become U.S. citizens. During the last presidential election, Trump performed better in Minneapolis neighborhoods with large Somali populations than he did in 2020. But Trump has launched diatribe after diatribe against the community in recent weeks, even as advocates and local leaders say that the Department of Homeland Security seems to have launched new efforts to target undocumented immigrants. Minneapolis residents and local officials say immigration officers appear focused on Somali neighborhoods. "It's unclear how many people have been detained so far," local officials say. DHS didn't respond to an email seeking comment. Dee Doe, a community organizer with the Minnesota Immigrant Rights Action Committee, said at least 30 people had contacted their group Wednesday, reporting that they had been stopped by immigration officers in their cars, at bus stops, on the street, or visited at their homes. "There's a tangible level of fear that you can feel, especially among the Somali community right now," she said. The Trump administration also launched a new immigration enforcement operation in New Orleans this week, part of sweeps across the country, including Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Chicago, resulting in thousands of arrests, legal challenges, and protests. In both Washington and Chicago, data shows that most of the immigrants detained do not have criminal records. Most recently, Tump's tirades have been directed at reports of extensive fraud in Minnesota's social services system, in which dozens of Somali individuals are accused of stealing millions in government funds. The funds were intended for housing for disabled adults, food security for children, and support for children with autism, but were allegedly spent on personal luxuries, including cars and real estate. Somalians ripped off that state for billions of dollars, billions every year, billions of dollars, and they contribute nothing, Trump said this week. He also said that he would end the temporary protected status held by a relatively small group of Somali migrants living in Minnesota, which the Immigration Law Center of Minnesota estimates to be about 700 people. But Trump's rant toward the Somali community in Minneapolis dates back to at least 2016, when he pointed to a mall stabbing rampage in the region carried out by a Somali immigrant as part of the bigger problem. Dahir Adan injured 10 people at a St. Cloud mall before he was shot dead by a police officer. Here in Minnesota, you've seen firsthand the problems caused with faulty refugee vetting, with large numbers of Somali refugees coming into your state without your knowledge, without your support or approval, Trump had said during a 2016 campaign stop. Minnesota became a magnet for Somali immigrants starting in the 1990s, after the outbreak of civil war in the East African country. About 40% of Somalis in the United States live in the state of Minnesota, and nearly 90% of them are citizens, either by birth or naturalization, said Jeffrey Passel, senior demographer at the Pew Research Center. Only about 1% are in the country illegally, he said. Minneapolis residents have taken pride in the city's status as a haven for refugee communities, including Somalis and Hmong immigrants.
Moving to the metro section, Jha to leave Brown University public health post. Jha will lead an initiative that aims to bolster the nation's defenses against emerging pandemic and biological threats. Dr. Ashish K. Jha, one of the nation's leading public health experts who became a household name during the COVID-19 pandemic, is leaving his post as the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health at the end of this year. Jha, a practicing physician with expertise in infectious diseases and former professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and Harvard Medical School, will go on to lead an initiative that aims to bolster the nation's defenses against emerging pandemic and biological threats. The initiative builds on the work he started at the White House during the Biden administration while on leave from Brown in 2022, which he further cultivated when he returned to Brown in 2023. In an exclusive interview with the Boston Globe, Jha declined to say who was involved in this new initiative, but said it would most likely be headquartered in the greater Boston area, and it would be independent of any university. He said he plans to take the next couple of months to really flesh out exactly how this is going to work and who the key partners are going to be. It's funny. In an ideal world, this would be fully baked, but I really want to focus on being dean, said Jha. A lot is happening in our country, and I feel like I really need to spend time focusing on working on really important issues around biosurveillance and pandemic preparedness, Jha added. Jha said there are increased risks associated with engineered biological agents, given all the progress the globe has made in engineering biology, even for all the good he sees in cell and gene therapy. Those same technologies can be used for nefarious purposes, Jha said. At the White House, he found broad consensus among policymakers, experts, that we didn't really have the systems we need to detect those things to respond effectively. Jha, who's also contributing Globe opinion writer, was appointed to lead the School of Public Health in February 2020, weeks before COVID-19 became a major health public health crisis. Under his leadership, the School of Public Health has experienced a period of growth and expansion, including an opening in an office in Washington, D.C. in 2024, and contributing to the national impact of the university's Pandemic Center, which launched in 2022. The school has also increased its influence in the areas of climate change and public health, health policy reform, and overdose prevention. As the U.S. and other nations have continued to witness the impact of avian flu, Mpox, COVID-19, and other infectious diseases, Ashish's work can bring scientists, policymakers, and organizations together to develop solutions to confront a new era of biological threats, said Brown Provost Francis J. Day Doyle III in a statement. Graduate student enrollment at the school is also at an all-time high, having more than doubled since 2020. More than 660 students are actively enrolled, which is the largest graduate population in the school's history. We have rapidly become one of the leading public health institutions on key issues, such as how we protect the world from biological threats, mitigate the health effects of climate change, improve the quality and efficiency of our healthcare systems, and target addiction to reduce its burden on our population, Shaw said. Under Biden, Shaw served as the White House's coronavirus response coordinator. Prior to arriving at Brown, Shaw served as the faculty director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. While in that role, he was a practicing general internist at the VA Boston Healthcare System. At the Harvard Chan School, he also served as dean of global strategy from 2018 until departing to work at Brown. His legacy at Brown will be his cultivation of high-impact initiatives that improve the health and lives of millions of people around the world, said Brown President Christina H. Paxson. We have strengthened our reputation for leveraging data and science to develop solutions to complex public health challenges. Shaw will officially depart Brown on December 31st. Dr. Francesca L. Bodoin, academic dean of the School of Public Health and a professor of epidemiology and emergency medicine, will serve as interim dean of the school. Shaw praised Bodoin and said she knows the school inside and out, and she's going to take it to new heights. In a moment of reflection, Shaw said the pandemic undermined a lot of trust in public health and that breaking down miscommunication will be a factor in his new initiative. Most Americans now know what public health is, but not always for the better, said Shaw. You can build the best technical system, but you can't communicate effectively and people aren't bought in, nothing is going to work.
Suspect tied to January 6th pipe bomb in D.C. is arrested, following years of false leads and conspiracies. Federal agents arrested a Virginia man Thursday on charges that he planted two pipe bombs on Capitol Hill the night before January 6, 2021, a breakthrough that came after years of false leads and rampant conspiracy theories, some promoted by the same FBI leaders who took credit for cracking the case. The man, Brian Cole Jr., 30, had been charged with transporting explosive materials across state lines and with the attempted destruction of buildings with explosives, according to court papers filed in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. He was expected to appear there in front of a judge on Friday. The arrest of Cole, taken into custody Thursday morning at the home he shared with his parents in suburban Woodbridge, provided potential closure for an enduring and politically charged mystery. Who planted bombs outside the national headquarters of the Republican and Democratic parties on the eve of congressional certification of Joe Biden's 2020 victory? Neither device exploded, but their discovery around 1 p.m. on January 6 added to the fear and confusion on a day when a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol and fueled conspiracy theories among Trump's surrogates, the now deputy FBI director among them, that it was an inside job intended to discredit the right. At a Justice Department news conference Thursday, Kash Patel, FBI director, said that the break in the case was not based on new information, but came after agents bore down yet again on their investigative files and connected the dots that eventually led to Cole. Patel and Attorney General Pam Bondi both declined to discuss Cole's motive. Patel, offering ritualized political flattery, thanked President Trump, along with federal investigators, for solving what he described as a case of massive public importance. Investigators have not been able to determine clear-cut political intent behind Cole's planting of the bombs or why he targeted both parties. But he is speaking with federal agents who hope to learn more about his thinking, according to two people familiar with the matter. A 7-page FBI affidavit offered a glimpse at the painstaking jigsaw puzzle effort that led to Cole's arrest after nearly 5 years and dozens of unfulfilled leads. Patel and Bondi did not say what drew the investigators to Cole in the first place, but the affidavit noted that agents were able to use his cell phone to track his location on the night the bombs were set, then compare it with surveillance footage of the path that would-be bomber took on the evening of January 5th, while cloaked in a mask, dark pants, and a gray hooded sweatshirt. They viewed bank accounts and credit card records to track purchases from local stores, including Home Depot, where he picked up components of the weapons, galvanizing piping, 9-volt batteries, electrical wire, steel wool, and white kitchen timers. Darren Cox, the head of the FBI's Washington field office, which has been handling the inquiry, said at the news conference that the Bureau has never deviated from its mission to catch the pipe bomber. "We do not forget," Cox said. "We do not give up, and we do not relent." While arresting a suspect in the case was a significant achievement for the FBI and the Justice Department under Trump, Bondi used the moment to criticize Biden, falsely claiming that the case had been left to languish under his administration. In fact, the FBI had gone to great lengths to identify the would-be bomber almost from the moment the explosive devices were discovered, circulating video clips of a figure walking on Capitol Hill it said had left the devices. Investigators conducted hundreds of interviews and produced intensive profiles on 5 to 10 suspects in the first 2 years of the inquiry, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. Agents also obtained a trove of location data from cell phones and digital advertising services, trying to find people who had bought devices similar to those used in the bombs, and issued subpoenas to 18 vendors that sold the Nike Air Max Speed Turf sneakers that the would-be bomber was wearing. This is a testament to the painstaking efforts of the career agents and prosecutors who have worked on this case for years, said Gregory Rosen, a former prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, who once led the sprawling investigation into January 6th. And while we don't know all the facts, we should be proud that the FBI has continued to investigate thoroughly. Over the years, conspiracy theories often filled the void left by the lack of an arrest. Many of them centered on the belief that the pipe bombs were put in place as part of a plot by deep state law enforcement and intelligence officials intended to discredit Trump and his supporters. Among those who have promoted these theories was Dan Bongino, a former right-wing podcaster who now serves as the number two official at the FBI. Trump, in one of his first official acts after returning to the White House this year, issued a grant of clemency to nearly 1,600 rioters charged in connection with the Capitol attack. His proclamation was extraordinarily broad, covering all defendants accused or convicted of offenses related to the events that occurred at or near the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021.
3 vocal concerts for the holiday season. At upcoming performances, you can sing along to The Messiah, hear music from early America, or experience an ethereal and wintry song of the woods. The winter holidays and singing groups go together like marshmallows and hot chocolate. Maybe it's the nostalgia that always goes with this time of year, yearning for the sing-alongs around the pianos of our childhood, or the ones we never had but wish we did. Perhaps it's some primeval instinct to call on the world's oldest instrument to make sure the nights don't get any longer, buried in our genome as residents of the Northern Hemisphere. Either way, there's no denying that December is the high season for group singing of all kinds, and there are plenty of opportunities to take in some festive performances or even participate in some yourself. Of the many musical offerings in and around Boston during this season, here are some choral choices that won't miss. The old favorite, Messiah. Several local musical institutions per year put up Handel's Messiah, and if you didn't get your fix with Handel and Haydn Society last week, or one wasn't enough, my recommendation is without question Boston Baroque, which this year sees Handel's Oratorio conducted by someone other than now-retired founder for the first time in, has this ever happened before? Filippo Ciabatta, the ensemble's assistant conductor, leads 2 performances in the singer's acoustic paradise that's New England's Conservatory's Jordan Hall. The 4 featured vocal soloists are all company veterans, soprano Amanda Forsyth, a local diamond who made her professional debut with Boston Baroque in 2001 and has logged over 40 performances with the ensemble. All that said, the beating heart of Messiah is always the chorus, and Boston Baroque runs their Messiah with a reliably on-point ensemble of 25 voices. December 5th, 7:30 p.m., December 7th, 3 p.m., New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall. If you prefer to sing along with Unto Us, A Child Is Born, instead of leaving it to the professionals, there are several all-welcome Messiah sing-alongs around town, hosted by organizations including the Cathedral Church of St. Paul, December 17th, Cambridge Chamber Ensemble, December 20th, and Harvard Unitarian Universalist Church, December 21. The Musical Time Machine, Boston Camerata. Boston Camerata has crafted a cornucopia of holiday programs in its 70-plus years of existence, and it usually performs two of them every December. This year's offerings both originate from Emeritus Music Director Joel Cohen's long tenure, but current director Anne Azema has revised and augmented them. Sing We Noel, Christmas Eve from England and Early America, features several centuries' worth of carols, hymns, and instrumentals, while The Midnight Cry and American Christmas focuses exclusively on American music of the 18th and 19th centuries, including Songs of the Shakers and several tunes published in Shape Note New Tune Books. It speaks the incredible vastness of Camerata's repertoire that despite their adjacent themes, the programs have only the tiniest bit of overlap. Sing Me Noel, December 6th, 7th p.m., Central Congregational Church, Newburyport, December 7th, 4 p.m. Old South Church, sold out. The Midnight Cry, December 21, 4 p.m., First Church in Cambridge, www.bostoncamerata.org. The Eclectic, Lorelei Assembly. Lorelei Ensemble prefers to blaze new trails rather than retread old paths, so it doesn't usually keep repertoire in rotation. But the ethereal and wintry Northwoods by Scott Ordway is an exception. The piece was written with Lorelei in mind, and it premiered in 2014, not long after the group was established. In October, the group finally released a recording of the piece on contemporary concert music label New Focus. The piece is at the center of their touring program, Frost and Fire, surrounded by medieval chant, American hymns, world premiere arrangements, and one entirely new work from the group's call for scores by early career women, non-binary, and transgender composers. December 11th, 7:30 p.m., the Memorial Church of Harvard University, Cambridge. Yeah?
Bah humbug, here are five of the most hissable Ebenezer Scrooges in TV and film, and one irredeemable version. By Odie Henderson, Globe staff, film critic. Ebenezer Scrooge has been around for 182 years. Not even the ghost of Christmas yet to come could have predicted the longevity of Charles Dickens' most miserly of misers. Since 1843, A Christmas Carol, in prose, being a ghost story of Christmas, to use its full title, has been a staple of Christmas time reading. The advent of cinema and television brought numerous adaptations to screens big and small. A Christmas Carol could be found on theater stages as early as 1844. I'm sure that Mr. Scrooge would yell, "Bah humbug!" at all these versions of his life story on stage and screen, at least before those ghosts got him to lighten up. He'd probably demand that the purveyors of bad productions be sent to workhouses and prisons. And I'm sure he'd question why so many versions have musical numbers in them. But then again, he might have been proud to know that such fine actors as Alistair Sim, Albert Finney, and Mr. Magoo have played him, not to mention Patrick Stewart, Bill Murray, and Scrooge McDuck. I know Scrooge would definitely be happy that a notoriously bad actor named Odie Henderson did not play him in a high school production of Christmas Carol. I didn't get the part, and as revenge, I took five other parts in the play. I even got to waltz, because my dancing clearly outshone my thespian skills. Regardless, I harbor no ill will towards Charles Dickens. It's a tradition for me to read A Christmas Carol every December, and I try to watch one movie version as well. Readers will know of my affection for Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, the 1962 cartoon version with incredibly good songs by Jules Stein and Bob Merrill. That's my favorite version. It was a staple of my childhood television viewing. But here are five other Scrooges worth noting, plus one that deserves the biggest bah humbug. Alistair Sim in A Christmas Carol, 1951. This was another version that cropped up every Christmas on the independent New York City channels of my youth. Sim is widely considered the greatest of all movie Scrooges, thanks to his multi-layered performance. You can see and feel the changes in his Scrooge. This British production is often considered the finest adaptation as well. Sim is equally good before and after his run-ins with the ghost of Christmases past, present, and future. And I mean yet to come. Before she was in Mary Poppins and on TV's Maude, Hermione Baddeley played Mrs. Cratchit in this movie. It's available on Canopy and Prime. Albert Finney in Scrooge, 1970. Charles Dickens and musicals do not mix. And yes, I've heard of that picture, Oscar winner Oliver, perhaps the only musical I hate more than La La Land. But, as previously mentioned, the Bah Humbugs are often accompanied by songs in these adaptations. So in 1970, viewers got Tom Jones warbling songs as Scrooge. And by Tom Jones, I don't mean the singer. I mean Albert Finney, who played the titular rogue in 1964's Best Picture Oscar winner, Tom Jones. The songs by Leslie Bricusse are so bad they're good, and Finney acquits himself nicely considering the circumstances. The next is Michael Caine in The Muppet Christmas Carol, 1992, Patrick Stewart in A Christmas Carol, 1990, and George C. Scott in A Christmas Carol, 1984. The biggest Bah Humbug is Bill Murray in Scrooged, 1988. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to the Talking Information Center. I'm Pam.
And Pamela.
Have a great weekend.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party? You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our 15th. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy. You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year. At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local. I can send you with a link.
Okay.
Smart.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I need an assistant to help you prevent wildfires.
Dude, I've got this. I've been camping since I was 5 years old.
But I am a camping influencer.
You know what? I'll bet you $5. Assistant Smokey, what is the best way to put out a campfire?
To put out a campfire, drown with water, stir, drown again, then make sure the fire is out cold by feeling with the back of your hand.
Wait, really?
I'll take the $5.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
If you can plan barbecues and weddings, you can plan to protect yourself from a natural disaster. Sign up for local alerts, prepare an emergency kit, and make a family communications plan. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRS LP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJM Framingham.